Rock had set up the aircraft detector grid that Schechter's people had supplied. It could even differentiate types of aircraft. The next day, at 11:57 a.m., it picked up the plane. Roxham came outside where the rest of the team was watching the sky.
See it, Rock? An Aleutian N-3A twin jet. Think that's our man?
If it's not, it's a hell of a crappy attack squadron. Make some more coffee, McCoughlin. And eggs and grits. I'd like to get to know Major Saransky before we head north with the man.
Oh, that's him coming down.
Hey, look at him kicking his little legs.
He doesn't seem to know what he's doing. He's so fat. He looks like a wiggly little marshmallow.
He's coming down pretty fast.
I don't think he knows how to prepare to land, Rock.
No, I don't think he does. Man incoming! Okay, he's alive.
Detroit, Chen, go help him out of his harness. McCoughlin, didn't happen to spot a tracking device?
No, Rock, I didn't. But here comes the plane again.
Ah, that must be it, coming out now.
And here comes our new friend now.
Any problems, guys?
He had some problems getting out of his harness, but he's okay.
Thanks, comrades, for all that help back there. And here comes the antimatter meter.
I suppose that's the missile tracker.
Yes, it's 40 kilograms. I didn't want to jump with it. Actually, I've never jumped before. It's exhilarating.
Never jumped before? Aren't you in the Soviet Army? Your insignia says you're a major, and you...
Well, I work in the lab. I'm sort of a lab major. Never had any combat experience. You know, got most of these medals here for inventions of a technical nature.
I see. Well, you'll have to experience a little pain on this trip. I hope you have a strong heart, because you'll probably lose a few pounds. Quite a few.
It looks like a tripod-mounted SMG.
But it isn't, see? The barrel is solid, uses measuring scopes. I'll have a trace on the radiation of Kilov's missiles once you get me to the point they were stolen from. And I can do some initial distance readings.
Well, man, let's get some breakfast in you and get going. You ever eat wild boar ham and eggs with grits back in Leningrad, pal?
All right, Saransky, what's the plan?
Simple. You do as promised, so do I. We find the missiles and deactivate them. Send for a team to dismantle them and ship them back to Russia, as you rebels agreed. These weapons must be disarmed properly. We can't blow them up. They're antimatter bombs. They explode if strongly impacted. You are familiar, I suppose, with a Hiroshima bomb? The one that America dropped on Japan to begin the nuclear terror that still stalks the world?
Yeah, we dropped it, and it ended World War II, buddy. But we didn't start World War II, or for that matter, World War III.
Yes, well, each warhead contains 500 grams of antimatter.
The Hiroshima bomb was rated as being between 13 and 16 kilotons of TNT. Is this antimatter bomb more powerful with half a kilogram?
Well, keep in mind that the bomb that detonated over Hiroshima only actually converted 600 milligrams of matter into energy, and at a very inefficient rate. These antimatter bombs are much more efficient in both energy conversion and size of bomb. In fact, they may well be the most devastating weapons mankind has ever produced.
So just how powerful are these bombs, Saransky?
That is a military secret of the Soviet people. I don't have the authority.
So you know. You tell us or we'll have Archer play punching bag with you.
The Soviet scientist looked at Archer, who sat on a nearby desk, bending its legs under his weight.
They're rated at approximately 10 megatons.
10 megatons? That's absurd. The largest bomb ever dropped was 50 megatons.
The Tsar bomber, correct. That explosion created the mushroom cloud 60 kilometers tall. One was dropped over your Oregon, I believe.
Yeah, the president was there. Thanks for reminding us.
And keep in mind, Kilov has 5 missiles.
So Kilov is carrying around missiles that could...
take out the entire state of Colorado.
I'd guess we best get started, then. A little help opening the box?
How'd you help? Archer helped.
Thank you, Archer. Strange-looking thing.
And quite heavy as well. But a marvel of Russian technology.
So we're going to have to lug that thing all the way up to the Yukon? Why, the thing would take a breed of its own just to carry it.
Can't be helped. It's our only way of finding Kilov.
The free fighters gingerly set it down alongside the table. The antimatter meter was turned on by the Russian for demonstration purposes. The long silver cylinder with rows of buttons and meters on it throbbed and pulsed, and then, to their amazement, it started moving. It was turning like a compass needle. It managed this maneuver because it had small ball bearings on its lower side.
It keeps collecting antimatter traces, meson particles in the air. Normally, they don't even exist. If a missile has come by the area within 20 days, the AEM meter should start clicking like a Geiger counter does for any ordinary radiation.
Hey, look at what was also in the package. There's a bunch of these little red boxes. Oops.
Be careful, mister. Put them down carefully. They are very dangerous.
Okay. They look harmless enough, though. What's in them, Sharansky?
They're antimatter drains. They have to be attached to the missiles when we find them, inserted near the warheads. They deplete the antimatter. It's the only way to disarm the warheads. Aside from pulling a few wires in the electrical system, disarming the missiles is child's play. But we have to be very careful placing these little red boxes, as you call them, next to the warheads. They must be placed in such a way they are polarized to reverse the poles.
But they can't explode by themselves, can they? You said there were drains. How can a drain explode?
Antimatter drains have that capability, especially if jarred. Creates the explosive force of a hand grenade. The technical explanation is quite...
We'll handle them gently from now on.
Now, I volunteered for this mission. I hope you understand there will be... There must be no failure on your part, Roxanne, to help me deactivate the missiles. They are not to be merely captured. The agreement is that the missiles will be returned to their owner, the Soviet Empire.
We don't need or want your fucking missiles. We're winning without nuclear weapons or antimatter weapons or any of those things. Vasily knows that we'll never use weapons of mass destruction because we want this planet to survive. My side will go through with the agreement.
Very well. I will tell you what you need to know to help disarm the missiles, Roxanne, just in case something happens to me. We must make haste. If we lose Kilov, we might not be able to pick up his trail. We must never be more than 10 days behind him. 9 to be safe.
Does the meson radiation the missiles give out hurt people? That might be good to know.
No, it passes through the body. And it's likely to embed itself into the ground or ice below the tracks as they pass. The AEM meter works. I've tried it in Siberia when we lost one of the missiles being transported by air. Led us right to the crash spot.
So, there's still more of these missiles. Vasily said there were only these 5.
No, there was one other also being transported to Idaho. Premier was afraid they would explode by themselves, which is theoretically conceivable, though unlikely. He didn't want them on Soviet soil if I... Well, anyway... The 6th missile was damaged beyond repair and deactivated by one of those red boxes over there on the floor. I'm telling you the truth.
Roxanne assessed the man before him. He decided to trust Sharansky. For now. He had a hunch this wasn't the worst red he'd ever run into. He was a scientist. His eyes bespoke real intelligence and thought. He lacked the hard eyes Rock had seen so often in Russian officers. But he'd keep an eye on him anyway. Roxanne knew that Vasily was likely to double-cross them, if he could.
Such a bittersweet return. I can't believe all the damage Kilov's men have done to this fair city. Ah, well, with my oversight... Washington, D.C. will return to its old ways in no time at all.
Hello?
Hello. Let me in.
I'm sorry. Who are you?
I'm me, the president of the USSA.
President Zhabnov isn't here. He's in Russia.
I'm not asking for him. I am him.
Him who?
Him! I am President Zhabnov!
I told you already he isn't here. I have to go back to clean for Zhabnov's return.
I don't know who you think you are, lady, but you are...
President Zhabnov, you're back!
Yes. Please, let me go.
Ah, Mr. President, it's so good to see you back. How have you been?
Terrible. But first I need a brandy.
Of course. Come in, sir, please.
My time in Russia was not pleasant. Though you and I had made a daring escape from those treacherous KGB henchmen, I was not met by a hero's welcome in Russia. In fact, my reward for such outstanding service to the motherland was met by jeers. Jeers! Uncle Vasily himself called me a coward.
Your brandy, sir.
Thank you. So, I spent the last 4 weeks pushing papers under Ahala, the pompous ass. Thinks he's so smart just because he knows bureaucracy. Only once the KGB were driven out by the noble Sikhs did Vasily allow me to return.
I'm glad you are back, President Zhabnov. Though I must say, we were expecting you tomorrow. I had hoped we would be able to clean more.
Good enough. As I flew here, I saw the city. The cherry blossoms have been uprooted and torn. The Washington Monument has been cracked, its top fallen off. The Octagon has been destroyed. And worst of all, they crushed my flowers. My prized roses have all been destroyed by those KGB thugs.
I am sorry, Zhabnov. We are busy rebuilding right now.
Rebuilding? This place is a war zone. That lady thinks she can fix that hole in the wall with a vacuum?
We have only a skeleton crew left, President Zhabnov. Most of our staff was imprisoned or killed, and it takes time to send in men from Russia.
Show me the damage.
Gudinov took Zhabnov on a quick tour of his palace. The presidential office was a mess. Its shiny white paint was water-spotted, and the charcoal-gray smudges gave evidence of a fire. Zhabnov's floor-to-ceiling purple velvet drapes had been torn, and they sagged to the floor. The veneer of his immense cherry-top desk, inlaid with a presidential seal, was charred. The figure of a skull and the initial K was carved into its surface. His suite of Empire Salon furniture, recently upholstered in an eagle design of blue and gold, was faded, threadbare, and frazzled. The balcony hung precariously as if by a prayer. The 10-foot-high mirror that hung between the portraits of Washington and Lincoln had been smashed.
And the portraits? Where are they?
They are downstairs, sir. Removed during the KGB occupation for safekeeping.
Did the Stuart portrait of Washington survive?
Yes, President Zhabnov.
Damn it! Vasily won't let me toss it. I had hoped something good would have come from all this. I assume the Keen survived as well. The big-eyed tears? Good enough. The Keen survived, right?
I'm afraid not, sir. It had been slashed through. It was beyond repair.
The Keen! You have destroyed my gorgeous big-eyed tears? He will pay for this. He will pay.
The next 5 days of the Free Fighters expedition were uneventful. Roxanne, fearing a trap, had the team ride to a spot 50 miles north of the Idaho 5 base to intersect the only road north, old Interstate 15, outside Pocatello, Idaho. They'd try to pick up Kilov's trail there.
You know, Mr. Roxanne, our party could be helped along by a regular Soviet army. They're all under orders to track down Kilov as well.
And they're also under orders to shoot me on sight. Absolutely not. We're going on our own.
Well, then we should at least keep Vasily regularly informed of our progress. I have a radio I can use to contact the closest communications.
Forget it. We're talking about the same thing. Telling the Red Army where we are. We can't afford any overzealous asshole thinking he'll make himself some money by capturing the most wanted men in America. Vasily's not getting any progress reports until we're done.
At last, they reached the grass and cracks of I-15. Just 50 miles from the base from which the missiles had been stolen. Sharansky set up the tracking device.
Well, that thing saying anything?
Well, we just follow this road. Yes, he's probably taken it straight into Canada, see?
The tracker turned once, then points down the road.
How old is the trace? Can you tell?
Sure. He was here, a week ago, 7 or 8 days.
They found deep tracks in the mud-splattered highway. Huge convoy trucks with 24-inch tires carrying their loads of death north.
No need for further readings for a while, Major.
Right. Let's follow the footprints, man.
The moon swept up into the deep purple sky after sundown. Its gibbous elegance lit the rolling road before them with waves of white. On this night, it looked so cold, so untouchable against the radioactive glowing atmosphere of the Earth, striated with endlessly orbiting webs of pink and green strontium clouds. As he shifted in his saddle, Roxen patted his big mutant horse on the neck. It seemed a little skittish tonight. It knew. All the Brids sensed when they were going out on a mission. Sometimes, when his faint ESP powers were particularly keen, Roxen could read the thoughts of the big steeds, their strength, their simple needs, their devotion to man. The faces of Kim and Rona kept interfering with the stars above him. Their faces covered with blood, their shrieking as the red missiles dug deep into Century City's tunnels and exploded, melting flesh, memory, flashed in his mind. The fearsome image kept burning in his head. He gritted his teeth together, gazed past the strontium clouds, beyond the bands of pink and green, writhing like luminescent gargoyles far above, gazed on past the moon, beyond the stars. He searched and probed with all his heart for a god that he wasn't even sure existed, and pleaded with him to spare Century City. Keeping a slow, even gait, they rode on through the cool night, letting the Brid set the pace. They'd have to go slowly. The road was bumpy, pitted, but Rock didn't want to be behind schedule when the sun came up. In the morning, the tired riders saw the big wheel tracks veer off the road and continue overland, heading straight north. At last, they hit the Great North Prairie, and the Brids were able to pick up speed through the frost-tinged fields of sunflowers, dandelions, and clover. Edging his smaller Brid near Rock, Detroit came up to the lead. The two compatriots rode on quietly for a while, enjoying the early morning breezes and areas of winter winds, singing their happy greetings. The world could be beautiful at times. The tall, ice-coated prairie grass stalks glowed silver in the slanting sun. The manes of their steady steeds caught the same light and reflected it gold or tan. The easily visible tire tracks through the prairie took them to the 49th parallel, the old dividing line between the U.S. and Canada. The temperature fell. The sun was blotted by clouds of snow swirling in the bitter winds. The missile silos in North Idaho were hit 100 years earlier by the Russian missiles. Rock knew that was why nothing grew here, except crabgrass, spiky, sharp spines jutting from the thickening snow.
Kilov has come through here 5 days ago. The reading is quite definite.
We're gaining on the bastard. And just look at the hills ahead. Great for animals, but hell for a convoy of heavy trucks.
Though the truck's thick ruts were now obscured by the deepening snow, the AM tracker showed the way. A marker sign dangled to the side, barely legible. Welcome to Canada, it offered. Roxen set his face against the wind and saw a collapsed booth, a checkpoint, with nothing to check anymore. The team headed into Canada. The way was more gullied now. Occasionally, they could see the snow-muted tracks of the big wheels of Kilov's trucks, like the preserved tracks of some creature from the Pleistocene era. Roxen had that old feeling again. The mutant's sixth sense. It told him that they were being watched.
Good enough?
Yes, President Jabnov.
Are there any girls here to welcome me back to the White House?
No, sir. They all have escaped.
What? Of course they did. Take this down.
Yes?
I want you to round up a team of art experts to scour the land. Search every museum and art collection for undiscovered Keen paintings. Notify me as soon as they're assembled.
Yes, sir. Anything else?
No, you may leave.
Yes, sir.
As soon as Gudinov left the room and closed the door behind him, Zhabnov's stomach sagged. The effort of holding himself in was always a strain. The Red President gazed about the room after he changed into his pajamas. Even here in his room, Zhabnov couldn't escape the ravages of the White House. Buckets were placed strategically on his nightstand, bureau, and floor to catch the constant leaks. His carpet was water-stained, and his purple velvet curtains drooped. He stared at the emptiness of his king-sized bed. He was alone. He slid between the cold, damp sheets and stared vacantly at the darkened square that should have held his greatest portrait. He clutched the pillow tightly to his chest, as if for protection, and drifted to sleep.
Who's there?
Oh!
An eagle?
What's going on? I demand to know, as president!
You're not the president!
What? Who dares speak to the president as...
I'm president!
Who are you?
Look behind you.
All I see is... Stuart's painting of Washington.
Yes, I think that Stuart managed to grasp the essence of my spirit, don't you?
This can't be. You're only a portrait. I must be losing my mind to be talking to a painting.
Actually, I've been expecting you. Walk with me.
I've done nothing to you, Mr. Washington. I've even kept your painting.
My spirit has been troubled by your presence in my nation's hallowed halls. It is your disturbance of this place that has summoned me from my grave.
What? I didn't do anything.
Oh, but you did. You've come and taken over my country, my people. You may think that the power is on your side because of your weapons and troops, but we, the dead, have our eyes on you, Zhabnov. We're reaching for you to bring you down into our world.
We've come for you, Zhabnov.
Join us!
Zhabnov! Zhabnov! Wake up! You have an important telephone call.
Please, give it here. Hello?
President Zhabnov, this is Denkov. The siege on the monolith is going well.
When would you wipe out the enemy? I could use you back here.
Well, sir, the KGB are quite well organized. Though there are merely a few floors left, they are fighting tooth and nail. Sir, I would appreciate an extra...
How long until we have the monolith?
A week, perhaps.
Do it faster.
It was a gray day, the kind of day on which a man thinks of dying. White, broiling clouds overhead discharged a steady, heavy snow that blanketed their way and made visibility nil. Roxen kept the men moving through the deeper and deeper drifts. They leaned low on their thick-maned brids, using the pungent mops of dark golden mane as blankets, and zipped up their nylon super-insulated parkas. The Doomsday Warrior noticed that the treetops of the occasional evergreens they passed were starting to wave back and forth. That was bad. This kind of wind was the first signs of an Arctic blizzard, with untold feet of snow waiting to drop on the team. As the bridge stumbled on and the temperature dropped, the skies above grew dimmer and dimmer, as if it were night, though it was only one in the afternoon.
Ben, we'll have to make camp soon. Keep your eyes peeled for any kind of shelter and... Hold on, I think I see something. Detroit?
You want the binoculars?
Yeah.
Here you are.
Thanks. Halt! Yep. There's men coming this way. They're in dog sleds. Defensive positions, everybody. Take advantage of the terrain. Get over behind these frost buckles to the side of the road.
There were a dozen sleds approaching, with five or six men trailing each on skis, pulled along by ropes attached to the laden sleds, rifles slung over their shoulders or cradled in their arms. Through the electron binoculars' crisp laser-enhanced images, he could see the expressions on the Mongol stock faces, and they didn't look friendly. The free fighters waited, motionless in the snow, Liberator rifles steady in their hands. Waiting. The lead sled skidded to a halt, and the first five men approached, the others staying a bit back. Rock stepped forward, indicating he was the leader. Rifles trained on rifles, but at least they hadn't come in shooting. The leader pulled on his parka top of fur and sealskin and raised an empty hand. Rock raised his hand in the same universal gesture. The man stepped five paces forward as Rock waited, his hand ready to go for his quick-draw holster and the 12-gauge pistol that lay inside.
Hello! Why do you come this way? Are you Canadians? Do you speak English?
We're Americans, freedom fighters.
Ah, that is good. If you are who you say you are, and who are you?
Name's Ted Roxon, but you may know me
the
as...
Doomsday Warrior! Well, that's impossible. The Doomsday Warrior is 7 feet tall, at least. He is much more muscular than you are and has a voice like thunder. But you are the leader of this group that trespasses on the North Range, our land. Why do you trespass?
We are in pursuit of Russians who have stolen equipment that we want back. Dangerous equipment that could destroy all your people in a flash. Have you seen these Russians? They might not have worn regular Soviet uniforms.
Yes. Yes, we have. They came through 5 days ago. We tried to be friendly to them. In return, they killed five of my people. They stole much food and supplies. How do we know you are Americans and not Russians also?
And who am I addressing?
Tinglem, chief of the Nara Eskimos, king of the Aurora, lord of the tundra south of the Draco River.
Well, Mr. Tinglem, can your men put down their rifles and mine will do the same? Find it hard to carry on a conversation with guns poking out everywhere.
I'm afraid I can't do that yet. First, I need to know your real name.
I told you. My name is Ted Roxon.
Rock pulled down his hood as he walked towards them. Tinglem and his men all studied the man closely.
You have the multicolored eyes and the streak of white hair the legends speak of. But you are not 7 feet tall. Maybe just 6 feet. No, you can't be him. Perhaps I have something that can prove just who you are. Alma!
From the most distant sled, a figure stepped forward. A figure of enormous girth, swaddled in furs. A man-monster, 7 feet tall at least. His hands were chained together, and he strode like he owned the world. The Eskimos made a wide path for him. He came up alongside Tinglem and dwarfed the big man.
This is Almo, our slave. We captured this wild man last year. Sometimes we pit him against the fighters of other tribes. We have won much food and much ammunition from them.
Pleased to meet you.
I don't believe you are who you say you are. And that means you are probably lying about everything. If you are the Doomsday Warrior, you could defeat Almo in a hand-to-hand battle.
Well, sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not in the mood to fight anyone today. Nevertheless, I am the Doomsday Warrior, and we are Free Fighters.
You are not the Free Fighters! Almo will battle you, and if you are the Doomsday Warrior, you will defeat him.
And if I don't feel like proving myself?
We will kill you all. We're not in a very trusting mood right now. I'm sure you understand.
Are there any rules?
No guns.
That's fine by me. Detroit?
Yeah.
Keep hold of my jacket.
Unchain Olmo!
Once Olmo was free of his bonds, he shucked his sealskin jacket, stripping down to his hulking bare chest. The man was like a sumo wrestler, but more muscled and covered with thick brown hair. He hardly looked human. And with his face twisted up in a snarl, lips curled back over jagged teeth, Rock felt as if he were facing something from a prehistoric age.
Are you ready? Then fight!
The two started to circle each other, sizing up each other's strengths and weaknesses. Olmo, as quick as a cat, lunged for Rock's neck. Roxon twisted and slipped free.
No guns, then? I'm not gonna waste time in hand-to-hand combat.
Alma! Here!
The beast went to the harpoon sticking in the ground. He yanked it out and smiled a jagged smile of menace. Rock saw Olmo's eyes dilate and traced his shoulders as the monster leapt in for a killing strike. Olmo stepped back and felt his abdomen. The blade had barely made contact as the man was able to stop his great bulk in mid-stride. Still, there was a thin line of blood along the giant's stomach. The maddened fighter opened his jaws, showing his bent rows of broken teeth. He made what Rock could only interpret as a smile, though hardly a friendly one. He practically drooled in anticipation of a worthy foe. Rock hefted his knife at chest level, moving it from side to side, ready for whatever attack Olmo chose. He had decided to let the Arctic monster do the attacking. He would counterattack. The man was too big for Rock to go in. Let him make the first move. Olmo fainted to the right. As Roxen responded, he twisted and came at the American's side with a harpoon. Rock's side felt wet. The harpoon had gouged out a half inch of flesh, but Olmo had paid for that blow. He was currently nursing a pair of bruised testicles. His opponent off balance, Rock moved in for the kill. But Roxen had overestimated the damage he'd made, as Olmo grabbed his skull with one hand. Not missing a beat, the giant threw him to the ground. Roxen just managed to roll out of the way, but the creature had already turned to face the Doomsday Warrior. The harpoon was hanging in the air, ready to stab. Having no other choice, Rock took his knife by the blade and threw it with all his strength at the forehead of his murderous adversary.
Detroit, can you give me back my parka?
Rock, you might want to wait a bit before that, but turn around!
You're not safe.
Olmo was standing again, a knife through his forehead, his eyes half bulging out, blood pouring from his mouth. The blade stuck clear through the back of the shattered skull. Immense arms again sought for Roxen. With a knife right through his head, still he stumbled on. Maybe the damn thing didn't even need a brain. On the ground, Rock spotted Olmo's harpoon. Chances are the beast couldn't even see it. Rock encircled the dying monstrosity for a few seconds, and then suddenly jammed the harpoon straight into the monster's gut. The jagged, serrated edge trailed guts as Rock pulled it out. Olmo staggered backward, looking at the free fighter in bewilderment. His legs trembled violently as they tried to hold up the quarter ton of weight. Roxen stared at the half-human mutant and wished it had all been different. The man was cruel, but he was brave as well. If he had been with the free fighters, he would have made a hell of a warrior. But such was not to be his fate. Rock stabbed again, this time for its neck.
Convincing.
You are the Doomsday Warrior.
Tinglum fell to his knees and touched his hands together in front of him as if in prayer.
Excuse me for doubting you, Guard Roxen.
Oh, really? Come on, stand up. I had to kill Olmo because you think Roxen is a god, not a man? Now you must help me. Help us defeat Kilov and his men. That's what I ask. Help, not worship.
Yes, of course. Whatever you wish shall be. Come to our village. Be feasted, bathed, fed as friends should be.
Well, that sounds pretty good.
Two 200 miles northwest of Roxen's party on the Alcan Highway, Colonel Kilov watched the snowy terrain move by at a good clip from his warm and cozy cushioned chair in the nose of his all-terrain vehicle. Equipped with every convenience, the treaded trailer had been built for General Dursky of Zhabnov's Supreme Missile Command. But Dursky was no longer among the living, and Kilov had inherited the vehicle when his troops captured Dursky's 5 truck-mounted Magon II missiles in Idaho. Kilov had lost 489 of his last 700 crack Death's Head commandos in that raid, but it had been worth it. Now, he was headed north toward the Arctic Circle, with 5 missiles on balloon-tired trucks behind him. In another 9 days, more or less, he would be within firing distance of Moscow itself, and his near rout in America, his failure to take over America, would be reversed, armed with the unstoppable Magon 2 cruise missiles that could fly 80 feet off the ground at 2,800 kilometers an hour. Vasily would have no choice but to surrender the Soviet world empire to Kilov's ironclad rule, or Moscow would be vaporized by the antimatter warheads of the missiles. If Vasily doubted that Kilov would destroy Moscow, Kilov would fire a missile toward Colorado, where he knew the American base called Century City was located. The entire west-central part of Colorado would be vaporized. That would show Vasily he meant business, and would also get Kilov's nemesis, Ted Roczen, the Doomsday Warrior, out of the way once and for all. The well-equipped trailer he traveled in now was nothing compared to his living quarters on the top 2 floors of the Denver Monolith. There, he had 100 servants, a command center that controlled hundreds of swift choppers, and 50,000 troops. Now the Monolith was besieged, soon to fall into the hands of the Red Army. But he would have it back, very soon. They all thought he was beaten, but he wasn't. Repayment was about to be made. He would aim the missile just far enough away from Denver to have the mountains to the immediate west of the city shielded from total destruction. Of course, Denver and half its million inhabitants would be shaken. Many would die, but the monolith would stand. Then a few weeks later, his loyal troops and defectors from the regular army, hopefully once they saw his power, would reoccupy his headquarters, restoring his capital to its dark prominence. Big plans. Plans that depended on no one knowing where he was for the next 9 days, until Moscow was in his missile's range. Then, everybody would know, and nobody would be able to stop him.
Wait. No. That's Heitenau. I wanted a Semenov. That's better. Let me counteract that Heitenau with a drowser on. Oh, perfect. Mershniff, how far north are we by the inertial readings?
100 miles north of the 49th parallel, Your Excellency.
And our speed?
Only 30 kilometers per hour, sir. The terrain is quite bumpy and cracked, and wind-blown drifts make it difficult for the tin half-tracks carrying the troops, and even for the missile trucks.
Nevertheless, I want to reach the 54th parallel tonight. We've no time to dawdle. Notify all to move faster.
Yes, Your Excellency. Immediately, Your Excellency.
Such anticipation. Soon, I will be the first man to explore the Yukon's mountains in 100 years. But I have troops and equipment and a protector. Death will not take me. Not until I have accomplished his bidding on this planet. With Vasily dead, I will have USSR. With Roczen dead, I will have USSA. Then I will force the entire world to be united under my absolute rule. Then I will destroy it in a million atomic fires. I will end it all. I will be the last to live, the only one to see it. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. First, Moscow has to surrender. Then a brief atomic war of subjugation, nuking the rebel territories of Australia, South Asia, and the Micronesia Free States. Then, when the world is mine, I will press the button and blow everything, every living thing on the 5-billion-year-old planet Earth, away. My master Death would be most.
Rock saw wisps of smoke in the air, and when they crested a hill, there lay the Eskimo village. It was a group of several dozen igloos, shimmering like immense half-pearls in the vast blanket of snow. Children played on small sleds pulled by husky pups. Women came out of the igloos, though bundled as they were, it was hard to tell what sex they were. Only their softer complexions and long, silky black hair showed their gender. Roxen followed Tinglem to the largest white ice igloo, as the rest of his team were left to wander about and experience the culture.
How the hell do you build these igloo things anyway?
Must be done carefully. The entrance must not be in the direction that the prevailing west winds, but perpendicular to it. The igloos are just domes made of ice bricks. Actually, wind snow. Highly compact and hard snow we cut in the nearby drifts and cart here. They are laid upward in a spiral of diminishing diameter. If we had wood for scaffolds, we would make bigger ones. We migrate anyhow, so we abandon these igloos when the snowfall gets too heavy and buries them completely. Come, let us enter. Watch the ice steps, Roxen. They're steep and dark.
They passed through curtains and entered the open space inside, a cozy chamber hung with pelts. In the middle of the room, a small metal stove let its heat into the center, but not the edges of the room. The walls were all glazed ice.
Come, let us have some tea.
Rock and Tinglem sat alone by the small metal fireplace in the center of the igloo, while the rest of the team explored other areas of the Eskimo encampment. Rock removed his ice boots and leaned against polar bear fur pillows while Tinglem prepared the tea.
Wow, this is really comfortable. But I don't understand how it can be, say, 60 degrees Fahrenheit here, and the ice wall doesn't melt.
Snow is a very good insulator. All the cold air is trapped in the tunnel inside, and the warm air rises in here, the main living area. The air, which is a poor conductor of heat, does melt the snow it touches, but the snow refreezes and turns back to ice very quickly. It is a special brew, for visitors only. Very rare. Enjoy.
I'm pretty good, yeah.
After the tea, the Nara chief told the Doomsday Warrior legends of how his people experienced the nuke war 100 years earlier.
My tribe saw the white lines in the sky, followed by the blossoming of orange glows in the south, in the United States and southern Canada. That glow was followed a few days later by a terrible storm here, and then the falling of the burning rains. There are tales from the old ones, who were children then, of mysterious sickness. Red boils on the skin, dryness of throat, a gradual withering away of the limbs, and then the birth of strange, mutated children, some more like fish than humans. The mutants were buried alive in the snows near the sacred mountains. Hunting was bad, and the village was starving by spring. All the land grew dry, withered, deserted. The lakes had no boats in them in the spring. The rivers and creeks had no canoes in them. No red-coated moose hunters came through our town asking for guides. It is told that one of our young men took a sleigh to find out what had happened. He set off to Nome, Alaska. When he came back, he was all sickly and spotted. He died. But not before telling my people that instead of a white man's city, it was only a great circular ice lake with the scattered burned bones of tens of thousands lining its shores. So my people stayed in this area. Our medicine men told us not to wander, for the rest of the world had been poisoned by the Great Evil War. So we have stayed in this area and hunted as best we could and found the leaves and berries to supplement our meager larders. My people were alone, cut off from the outside world, reduced to a few dozen families. Forsaking the old ways in a desperate search for food, we headed south where the game was more plentiful. Came upon this unspoiled area. Here we thrived, alone, for 70 or 80 years. Finally, others came. And we have traded with other Eskimos and Indian tribes for the last 30 years. Our people grew so numerous that we split up. We of the Nara clan stayed in this area, near the ocean and fish. Others went into the forbidding Sasquatch Woods, and beyond it, built the Ice City.
What's the Sasquatch Woods?
The Sasquatch, I believe, is what your people once called the Bigfoot. Great, hairy beasts with the strength of 20 men. Alma may have been the offspring of human and Sasquatch parents. Although they have few weapons except for the huge rocks they throw, and they can throw enormous boulders, they have taken over all the land north of the Draco River. They do not cross it, however. They fear deep water, and at this time of year, they usually hibernate in caves.
Rock could hardly believe all he was hearing, but he would soon find out. He decided that the Eskimos were great storytellers, and that Tinglum was one of the best. But it was time for practical matters, not tall tales.
This is great, really, but we've got to get going. I'm going to need supplies.
Whatever we have is yours, for a price. I will sell you one sled with a husky team thrown in for, say, one of your rifles and 200 rounds of ammunition.
I'll give you 4 rifles and 100 rounds each. But I want 8 sleds and dogs, one for each of my men. I'd like to leave here in 8 hours.
Ah, you're in a rush. In that case, things will be more expensive. You understand?
Well, not really a big rush.
Of course. Tell you what, we'll send for your big arrow-shooting friend, and he can bring some samples of your trading goods, particularly your skis of metal and your rifles. And I want to see some of your clever objects, like that compass you carry on your belt. Maybe I can make a counteroffer. Wiglum!
Yes, sir?
Would you be so kind as to find our guest,
Archer.
Of course. Find Archer and tell him to bring all he can carry that might be a sample of what Roxon has to trade.
Rock started to wish he had allowed Tinglum to consider him a god. It could become a costly mistake not to have done so. 10 minutes later, Archer crawled into the igloo, carrying a vast mass of equipment.
Put it over there, right by the door.
Tinglum carefully inspected the Schecter skis, the compasses, sextants, knives, pistols, and camp gear Archer had brought in.
I will take all this, and I will give you 4 sleds and dog teams.
No dice.
This brought a pleased expression to the Eskimo's face. Out here, men spent hours bartering, happy for the companionship.
Very well. Let us inspect your other goods.
The two of them walked outside to Rock's brig, Snorter. Rock unsheathed his new Liberator rifle from alongside the saddle. It was one of the newer models that Rock had recently acquired from the arms factory. Tinglum's fat brown hands ran covetously along the barrel of the perfectly machined 9mm rifle. He looked at the weapon closely, snapped the 15-round banana clip in and out, admired the super-light Magnesteel simulated wood takedown stock. The weapon seemed to cause something approximating love in the man. He clicked the trigger, with the magazine out, of course, and then sighted along the barrel. Tinglum had pointed it toward a husky and had seen a tiny little red spot appear on the dog's fur.
It's just a laser-locking mechanism. When you sight a target, the rifle shoots forth a harmless red laser beam. The beam leaves a trace of light-activated phosphorescence, where it was focused. Then, if you pull the trigger and are off a bit, the bullets will skew to the right or left to find the target.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Perhaps I could up my offer for some more sleds and dogs.
Back in the igloo, Tinglum had Nara men bring in all kinds of artifacts, even jewels that Rock really didn't need but couldn't resist looking at. The Doomsday Warrior nearly gasped out when he saw 2 neon blue rabbit skin robes. They were beautiful, soft, and iridescent, catching every bit of light and reflecting it. Rock wanted them for Rona and Kim. The robes were of 2 sizes, 1 just right for each of the women.
You like the robes? Took 150 rabbits apiece to make them. And not ordinary rabbits. Neon rabbits. They have pelts that are spectacularly blue, like the feathers of a peacock. It takes great skill to catch a neon rabbit. Then the pelts have to be dried and hung up in narrow strips. Then they are dressed and sewn together with walrus gut, very strong. Then they must be hung up in evergreen trees to catch the light of the aurora borealis, enhancing their color so that these robes are almost ultraviolet and glow. The coat that is made from them is light and warm. Wrapped in furs like that of the neon rabbit, a woman could walk in the coldest night without freezing.
Rock thought later that there might have been something in the tea to loosen up his mind, for he ended up trading quite a lot of supplies for the furs. Tinglem gave him good value back, though, for another 4 rifles, some rounds, and compasses. He would board the bridge while Rock traveled north and promised to return the mounts, no strings attached, whenever the free fighter came to claim them. They would be given foodstuffs for the trip, some of the harpoons the Eskimos used, a sled, and 6 dogs for every member of the party, warm pelts, and a brick of Eskimo black tea, guaranteed to heat up the blood. Plus, 4 clay gourds filled with highly volatile seal oil.
These gourds might save your life. Fuel to keep warm. Or to just make tea.
Thanks for the tip.
And Roxen.
Yes?
You need me too, Roxen. I'm coming along to help you on your way. The North is very unforgiving. I would not like to hear that the Doomsday Warrior died after I sent him on his way. We shall leave after a good rest for yourself and your men.
Roxen nodded and yawned. Some shut-eye was a good idea. An aged, frail man sat reading in his electric wheelchair on his solarium, a glassed-in veranda overlooking Moscow. He was reading On War by the Prussian military officer Karl von Clausewitz. The book had been the basis of military strategy for the entire 19th century. He wrapped his shawl more closely around him, as strontium-filled clouds passing over a wan sun cast chilling shadows over the city. Vasily, the grandfather, premier of the world, gazed at the gray clouds that seemed to be threatening to envelop his empire. He'd just been reading of a campaign that had been won because the enemy had been blinded by the glare of the setting sun. That sort of strategy would never work now. Life must have been simpler then. There were too many conflicting, constantly shifting forces in the world today. Not only were there rebellions in Afghanistan and China, but now, even in the USSA, the Soviet forces were divided into 2 camps, the KGB Blackshirts versus his Red Army. Vasily cursed himself for the 100th time for leaving those missiles hidden in America. He cursed himself for not having disposed of Kilov when he had the opportunity many years ago. His nephew, Zhabnov, though in general a fool, had repeatedly warned him that Kilov was getting too powerful. Vasily had ignored him, putting it off to jealousy on Zhabnov's part. But Zhabnov, for once in his life, had been right.
Yes, Rahala?
The communication to Washington, D.C. is ready, Grandfather. The operator has finally connected.
Yeah, thank you.
You may use the phone next to you.
Your tea, President Zhabnov?
Thank you. Any news from the field?
General Dinkov is making progress at the monolith, but he has restated his request
for... No, you idiot! I meant on the search for a Keen painting!
Ah, of course! We have been searching, but the telecommunications here have been ravaged by the KGB forces. I fear it may be a while.
I don't have a while! Have some men take a private jet to New York, Chicago, and all those other artsy cities. I need it now.
Yes, President Zhabnov.
Idiot. Dinkov is making progress. That's Premier Vasily's phone. Hello?
This is the Premier, nephew. How are you?
Just fine, Uncle. You should have seen the tremendous welcome I received here. Ah, the people love me. They showered me with flowers upon my...
Yes, yes, nephew. I know it must be gratifying to receive such a welcome. I am sure everyone is glad you are back. Have you read the orders I placed in your briefcase before you left Moscow?
Of course, I read them.
Well, what have you done to implement them?
Oh, why, everything possible under the circumstances.
What circumstances?
The White House is a shambles. Leaks are everywhere. We're operating with a skeleton staff, and my rose garden is ruined, and we're...
Stop whining, you fool! This is a matter of extreme importance. Intelligence has reached us that there may be KGB agents left in your area. They must be wiped out. You must re-establish your leadership over your scattered army before there is a counterattack.
But Uncle, Kilov is dead. He died when Roxen blew up the Octagon prison.
If I remember correctly, that was once your Octagon prison. But no matter. Nephew, you are forever misinformed. Kilov lives and has stolen 5 Megon missiles. He's now somewhere in Canada.
Tell me but where, Your Excellency, and I will instantly destroy him.
Fool. I've already taken care of the matter. I don't need your inefficiency to gum up the works.
I am sure, Uncle, that you will handle the matter most efficiently. But if I could be of any assistance...
I will let you know. But you will be of most assistance to me and yourself if you rally your troops. If you secure the eastern United States once more, round up the fragments of KGB traitors that still exist. Get your house in order, nephew, before it crumbles around your head. If this is beyond you, I can replace you with a smarter man. Rahala, for example.
Replace? But... you will be awed by my performance, Grandfather.
That would be a first... Good day.
Under Tinglem's close supervision, the quiet Eskimo community turned into a bustling beehive of activity. Men were put to work preparing hunting equipment. The women were sewing warm sealskin clothes, big enough for Roxen and his men. The rest of the village was occupied gathering the necessary items, portable stoves, fuel, blankets, tents, quantities of meat, narwhal, walrus, caribou, seal, and lesser game that had already been accumulated in the Eskimo camp for the long winter. All were brought to the trading igloo to be loaded on the sleds. The sleds chosen were the lightest and strongest in order to maintain the greatest speed to catch up with Kilov. The huskies were the most reliable and well-trained. Roxen stepped out of the comfortable igloo into the bitter cold, but clear, outside world. He flipped down his slit snow glasses to prevent snow blindness and put up his fur-lined parka hood. The sleds, which were always turned sideways off their runners when not in use, were set upright, ready to be loaded. The huskies were ready to be harnessed to them. 6 dogs to a sled, hitched up much the way a team would be hitched to a wagon. Tinglem and Rock walked around inspecting each dog. They were fine creatures, furry, healthy huskies. Not so distant relatives to the wolves that stalked the snow-wrapped hills. Each weighed about 80 pounds and had footpads of coarse black skin that tracked snow with surprising grip. Their ears perked up the minute anyone walked over to them, and they seemed to enjoy it when they were petted. Rock also noted that they had pretty good canine teeth. They were meat eaters and didn't care what sort of meat it was. He filed that away for future reference, just in case.
Ah, this here's Nikitl, the biggest of the dogs. I think you will want him, because he's such a good leader and responds well to the whip.
In short order, everything was made ready. Roxen and his men, Chen, Archer, Detroit, McCaughlin, Sharansky, Robinson, Peterson, and Farrell, helped load the sleds and harness the dogs. 9 sleds were loaded with 200 pounds each of expedition supplies. The 10th sled carried the antimatter detector, which Sharansky would continue to monitor from time to time to keep them on Kilov's trail.
Everybody ready to go?
I think so, yeah.
Good. Snorter, we're heading out. I'll be back for you, old pal. Here. Got some candy for you.
Rock patted him on the forehead and went back to the dog sleds. The dim sun went behind a hill. The day was ending long before it really began. The sun would be down for 20 hours. In the dimness, everything looked ghostly. The mound-like igloos, the slit eyes of the villagers watching the preparations. Even the dogs seemed to glow in the half-light. Some villagers lit torches to make the trek's preparation area more visible to them.
You know, Roxen, I'm glad you've come to us. It is time for adventure. That is the Eskimo way. It is fitting for men to go far and risk death.
Don't forget tea. Here you are.
Thank you.
The Eskimo husband took the tin from his wife and rubbed noses with her. She turned to Roxen.
Take care of Tinglem for me.
Ha! I'll be the one taking care of him.
Roxen winced, knowing it would be true. They would all have to rely on Tinglem and his special knowledge. Roxen had to trust Tinglem's choice of food, which wild plants and lichens were edible, and how to stalk the northern animals. They had to rely on game to feed the dogs and themselves en route. The Eskimo knew how to build an emergency igloo, and 100 other different ways to survive this Arctic wasteland. Most of all, Tinglem could navigate this uncharted wilderness when compass and sextant failed, and could find the fastest and safest route over difficult terrain. But he was a strong-willed man, unused to taking orders. Roxen knew this could pose a threat to his command. There were three ways to run such an expedition. One was to be an absolute dictator and decide everything for the others. Its opposite was to vote on everything. But a dictatorship would invite revolt, and total democracy got too unwieldy in times of extreme danger. Roxen would have to steer a fine line between the two, ask opinions, and then make the final decisions. But there could be only one leader. He had to find a way to show Tinglem who was boss at the outset, without seeming to do so. In a few moments, the opportunity arose to solve the matter.
Men, we must all stow our skis and ride with our feet on the skid ends of the sleds.
But that weighs down the sleds. We must move fast, Tinglem. We have to wear the short skis and glide behind the sleds holding on. It would take some weight off the dogs.
It won't work, because our feet will get cold from conduction to the snow. Also, the skis tend to get fouled up in the sleds. I know this from experience.
But these are special skis, designed by our own Dr. Schechter. They're not only shorter than regular skis, but they're made with an insulating alloy. Care to put them to the test? Your method against mine? We race a mile or so with the sleds, okay?
Okay, Mr. Roxen. We race from this igloo to that hill over there and back. It's about 2 miles round trip.
Before the men could prepare their respective sleds, word had passed through the entire village. Chen stomped out a starting line on the packed snow and made sure that both contestants' lead dogs were right on the mark. The excitement in the air was catching, and the dogs strained against their reins. Roxen wished he'd had more time to learn how to run the dog sleds. He didn't have time to worry, because suddenly, a man from the village rose the starter pistol. As Tinglem and Rock flew off and out of sight, all the men placed bets with each other as to who would win. Detroit took down the bets. Bullets, wine, clothes, and skis were all put on the line. After 10 minutes, McCoughlin looked off in the distance.
They're coming back.
Who's winning, McCoughlin?
It looks like, yes, it's Roxen. No, wait, Tinglem's in the lead. It's getting pretty close. They're neck and neck. Now it's Rock. Chen, get by the finish line.
Chen and an Eskimo got on opposite sides of the finish line in case it was a photo finish.
And the winner is... Ted Roxen by a length!
It was a decisive victory for Roxen's leadership. While Detroit was deciding who got what as far as the bets were concerned, Tinglem and Roxen put down their sleds and moved off to the side.
You were right about the skis. With my experience, I should have won. When this trek is over, I'd like to race you again. This time, I too will wear short skis.
Ah, but you forget. By then, I too will be experienced, and you'll still lose.
At that, you are correct.
Roxen knew that from this time on, he'd have no trouble with his command. Detroit, having completed the divvying up of the winnings, skied over to join Roxen and Tinglem. He looked disappointed.
What's the matter? You
You didn't bet against me, did you?
I got so busy taking bets that I forgot to place one myself.
I've got something to cheer you up. A big old bottle of Mugatoni brandy. This'll warm us up come nighttime.
All right, guys. You ready? Tinglem, you take the lead.
Roxon's sled followed Tinglem. Sharansky was next. He had charge of the sled with the antimatter meter. Robinson brought up the rear. The sleds crept forward, then, meeting little resistance to the snow, leapt forward. Chen managed to grab hold of the trail handles and slide along behind his sled on his steel skis. The sky was phenomenally clear. Galaxies of stars could be seen, and the moon shone down like a guiding beacon. It would be many hours yet before a belt of orange on the southeast horizon heralded the barely rising sun. It was a cold minus 26 degrees Fahrenheit. But all were rested and well-dressed. The sleds on the unbeaten track swayed and whispered over the snow. Mile after mile, Roxon kept his mutant senses on full alert. He could see Tinglem's sled to the front of him over the trails of his own dogs. His feet were beginning to feel numb. But it wasn't only the wind and cold that took his breath away. It was the awesome beauty of the northern landscape. Miles of snow in every direction looked like oceans or deserts turning purple, now pink, then orange, and finally gold with the glow reflected from the northern lights above. Snow hares could be seen sitting with their ears pricked alert, sitting motionless on the hills. Once he saw a caribou raise its regal, antlered head to gaze at them briefly before returning to feed on lichens hidden by the snow. In the distance, he could see some dark shapes. Mountains, indistinct, hard to make out. Clouds had appeared in the night with the growing light of the aurora's multicolored shifting curtain behind them and began to cast drifting shadows. Suddenly, Tinglem picked up speed. He was going faster and faster. It was all Roxon and his men could do to keep up with Inara. It seemed as if they were on a runway and were about to take off, when just as suddenly the Eskimo slowed and stopped. The other sleds almost rammed into each other.
What is it?
It's time for tea. The dogs need a rest.
Rest sounds pretty good.
The men were encouraged to take off their skis and stamp their feet to get their circulation going again. Within minutes, the tea was ready, heated on the porta stove. They sat around the heat on pelts. As the warmth of the tea coursed through their veins, a tale was spun by Tinglem about the birth of the world from a seal spat up by a polar bear. The free fighters listened with broad smiles at the drawn-out myth as they sipped from steaming cups. Above, the northern lights burned as if the very sky was on fire. Roxon noticed with unease that one of the auroral curtains seemed to shape itself like a bony hand and close. Then it was gone.